Station, this is Houston. Are you ready for the event?
I'm ready for the event.
Mr. Shatner, this is Mission Control, Houston. Please call station for a voice check.
I'm calling. This is Shatner. Do you hear me?
Mr. Shatner, this is the space research vessel, ISS, in Earth orbit. And yes, I hear you loud and clear. How do you hear me? This is Chris Hadfield.
Chris, I hear you loud and clear. It's such a pleasure to talk to you. I'm so moved to be able to speak to you for. I'm so moved to be able to speak to you for this brief moment. So I want to ask you some questions that have some deep meaning to me. So let me start off right away. You're in the International Space Station, but you had to get there in a Russian vehicle. Are we, as America, fallen behind, or is this just a pause on our space program?
The space business is an extremely difficult one, and if I think the best way to answer that question is to look at history. You know, we've never had regular access to space. We've had a space flight and then a landing, and then we review everything and make sure it's safe, and then we launch another one. And the shuttle was a successful vehicle, flying 135 times. But it's not like in between flights we could just count on the next one. Every one was really much the max level of effort that we could do. And so it went from Mercury to Gemini to Apollo to shuttle with many, many lulls in between. And the time it takes to build a new vehicle is quite long. So you could say we kind of lost our way in between every single launch. But in truth, that's not how it works. What it takes is an enormous effort of will and technical know-how to build a spaceship, and then to be brave enough to launch one, because you risk lives every time you do. And we're just right now in between vehicles, much as we were after Mercury, after Gemini, after Apollo. We're just in the after shuttle era right now. But fortunately, because of international cooperation, we're not grounded. And this place is built by the world and very much put together with the United States as the foreman. And fortunately, we didn't have to abandon it as we did Skylab, because we didn't have a vehicle or cooperation. Because of cooperation with other countries, people are here living and working. And the United States will build another vehicle, and that will come up here also. So it's by no means a lost way. It's just a natural path.
I read that you have already volunteered to go on a Mars mission. Does that have any reality to it? And because of the nature of this brief time, let me add to that question. You volunteered to go, but isn't that a fearful operation? Isn't that fraught with such enormous difficulty and danger?
You've taken a lot of risks in your life as well, and it was a risk that I decided to take many, many years ago. Really, to accomplish anything worthwhile in life is going to take risk. And even if you decide to stay at home and sit at your kitchen table, eventually the ceiling will fall, or there'll be a hurricane or a tornado. You can't live a worthwhile life without taking risks. And some things are really worth directing your life towards and putting your life on the line for. Let me just say, between the real life exploits of the first astronauts and the visually fantasized and enlivened ones like you portrayed on Star Trek and so many other people have in literature, they inspire people like me to do things like this. And without that inspiration, and then without the technological capability that comes along with it, none of it would be possible. And I'm in a position to say that the risks are infinitely worthwhile when you look at the view that's just out these windows behind me and the things that lie just beyond. And yes, going to Mars is inevitable, just as sailing across the Atlantic or flying across the Atlantic or orbiting around the world or going to the moon. It's just a matter of when we figure out how. We put ourselves together enough. We take those visualized dreams and fantasies and turn them into reality, which is what we're doing here right now.
You are you have many degrees in mechanical engineering, and you must see the universe in terms of how extraordinary a mechanical engineering feat that is, and how mystifying it is because we know nothing. Do you find yourself in the space station observing, as a scientist, a part of it, a removed from it, or are you able to be to see the unifying parts of it so that you become at one with the universe?
Luckily, I think, Bill, the answer is both. Most people, the highest they ever get is maybe to climb a tall hill or climb a mountain and look around, or even get in an airplane and start to see what lies beyond the normal two dimensions, the surface of the world of normal life. To have the opportunity to get as far away as we are here, and not only that, but to go around the world every 90 minutes, and you never saw it on stage while you were filming, but the view that they used to put in for us watching Star Trek of how the world looks out of Sulu and Chekhov's windows there, that's how the world looks. It's an enormous, wonderful, rolling Earth below us. But all you have to do is flip yourself upside down, and suddenly the rest of the universe is right there at your feet below you. And that's where the engineer in me, of course, is very much thinking about the ship and how we got here and the problems and the difficulties. But the human within me recognizes what we are in between. We've gone from climbing a hill, getting in an airplane, to now actually being right on the cusp of permanently leaving our planet, to everything else that exists. And I feel hugely connected to that. It's what was inspired in me as a kid, and I've kind of directed my whole life. I became an engineer and a fighter pilot and a test pilot to try and gain the skills to maybe someday do this. And now I'm doing my absolute best to help people see that, to help us understand where we are kind of philosophically and historically in our increased human understanding of where we do lie in the universe. Right. Those are great big words for a lab technician on a space station.
I
definitely get a sense of that all the time.
It's inspiring to hear. Let me go back to a moment. You've tested many airplanes. You've been a test pilot, which is like the utmost of example of courage, in that you're flying something unknown and you don't know what characteristics it's going to have. How do you deal with the fear, which is also applicable to going up into space and returning, which is perhaps even more fearful?
I read somewhere that you always knew your lines whenever you had a job in the acting profession. I have tried to always know my lines, whether it was as a fighter pilot or as an astronaut or as a test pilot. And the way I deal with fear is I try to define what it is that's scaring me. And what I'm scared most of is not knowing what to do next, you know, to be struck dumb on stage or to be responsible for a vehicle and not know the right actions to take with my hands or with the spaceship. And so I spent almost my entire adult life making sure that I knew my lines, that when the Soyuz spaceship, which I helped fly up here, that I spent years, of course, learning to speak Russian and then learning to fly that spaceship. And even though it flew itself basically flawlessly up here, no matter what happened, Roman Romanenko and I were ready to jump in and fly it and take over and do it all manually and fly it home. And that's a terrifying thing initially, but after years of training where you practice everything right down to the nth detail so you know you have the confidence that comes with that, then the fear diminishes. It feels like you're on the crest of a wave of ability, and that really diminishes fear.
Poised that perfectly as an actor who is fearful of the audience, but as long as you practice enough, you learn what to expect. The fear comes from something unexpected happening, like forgetting your words or an audience reaction that's unexpected. In my case, your face flushes and you get a sheen of flop sweat. In your case, you burn up. It's a little different.
Yeah, well, in both cases, you go down in flames, but one's figurative and one is not. But my wife, Bill, is actually, when people ask her if she's scared of what I do for a living, as you say, prior to this, I was a test pilot. That was a much more risky profession. I basically lost one good friend a year for the whole time that I was a professional high-performance pilot. And yes, this job has risk and a level that is fairly high. But there are lots of professions on Earth that have a lot of risk. The people, firemen and soldiers and some of the professions on Earth. And I respect them all for them understanding their job, really applying themselves and professionally getting their particular piece of work done in the world.
But there's another risk involved here as well. You're up there for 6 months. That's a long time to be away, isn't that?
It is. We have pretty good communications. Think of what you and I are doing right now. You know, you think about the stuff that was portrayed on television 40 years ago of people with a small handheld device standing on the surface of a planet talking to someone effortlessly who is orbiting that planet. That's what you and I are doing right now. And so I can do the same with my friends and family. I can talk to them pretty much every day. And so it's not that much different than just being on a long business trip. And training as an International Space Station astronaut takes you all around the world for years. So in truth, it's a 4 or 5 year period, of which 5 or 6 months you're in orbit. But with the level of technology we have right now, it removes a lot of the sense of remoteness to it. We're busy, happy, hardworking. And we still
that's
have
wonderful to
communication
hear.
With the world.
That's wonderful to hear, Chris. I'm getting a little nudging that we're running over time. So many questions about the future of space and the Mars mission and all. I would look forward to another time to speak to you in great depth and find out the larger implications of the questions that I was I've so briefly been able to ask you.
You know, those scenes when you were in Boston Legal, where at the end of the show, and you sit out sort of on the veranda or the balcony, and maybe over a cigar and a whiskey and talk of life, you ought to come to my cottage and sit on a porch. I would love the chance to talk with you about this and compare notes.
This is
a fabulous experience.
Northern Ontario is one of my favorite places. I'll bet you have a cottage up there.
Yeah, we have an Ontario cottage, and yeah, you ought to come visit. It's a great place to think about the world and watch satellites go over and really reflect on where we are.
I know
you were short on time.
I know the area. It's a pleasure, Chris. I look forward to meeting you in person and sitting down with a whiskey and a cigar.
All right, very nice talking with you. Thanks very much, and all the best.
Thank you. Same to you. Bye-bye.
Station, this is Houston ACR. That concludes your conversation with Mr. Shatner. Please stand by for a voice check from CSA headquarters.
Hello.
Greetings, Chris. It's Jeremy here with you at our home, the Canadian Space Agency. How do you hear me?
Jeremy, I have you loud
I'll take
and
that
clear.
As a yes.
Great to hear your voice, and hello to everybody. Hello to everybody in Saint-Hubert. Can you hear me okay?
We've got you loud and clear, too, Chris. We've got a number of questions here for you. We're going to get started with that, Chris. But before we do that, I just wanted to pass along some words on behalf of the agency. We're so incredibly proud of what you've been doing on behalf of Canada up there, and we're following you along every step of the way. So keep up the great work, and we really enjoyed listening to you this morning. So over to a couple questions.
Bonjour, Gilles Couture, enseignant en cinquième année. Mes élèves et moi aimerions savoir comment contrôlez-vous la qualité de l'air à bord de l'ISS?
La qualité de l'atmosphère, oui, et pour les élèves aussi. Oui, c'est absolument un problème. Et on manque ici, dans la station, on manque des plantes, des arbres. Et donc, il n'y a pas de système naturel pour ça. Donc, c'est peut-être le même comme dans un sous-marin, un vaisseau sous-marin. Nous avons les systèmes pour prendre les chimiques de l'atmosphère comme le CO2, le CO aussi, les gaz qui sont pas bons pour la santé. Il y a des systèmes pour filtrer ça et pour rafraîchir ça. Aussi, on prend de l'oxygène de l'eau et de l'urine ici pour reprendre de l'oxygène pour notre santé. Et chaque vaisseau spatial qui arrive apporte une quantité d'oxygène et nitrogène. Et avec ça, nous avons une atmosphère qui ressemble absolument à l'atmosphère sous Terre et bonne pour la santé, avec aucun problème. Et depuis combien d'années déjà? 11, 12 ans déjà, nous avons gardé la santé bien pour l'équipage ici dans la station et pour les prochaines, pour Jeremy après quelques années dans l'avenir aussi. Donc ça marche très bien.
Merci.
Merci Chris, on a seulement 2 ou 3 minutes qui restent. No question.
Hi Chris, this is Ryan Caverly. My question is, considering the recent success of the SpaceX Dragon spacecraft, do you think that the private sector will play a greater role in the development of Canadian space technology?
Well, the private sector has always played the biggest role in Canadian space technology. ComDev and SPAR and MDR, MDA and NEPTEC and all those companies, they've always been private sector companies. The real question is, who's the customer? And to be able to, of course, sell at the Canadian Space Agency and through the government, which is the big purchaser in the United States, too, where we're headed, we're sort of like in the railroad days, building the Trans-Canada Railway or building the airports, building the infrastructure so that then businesses could open. We're still in that stage. The biggest customer is still the government. But where SpaceX is headed, where we're all headed, that's where we ought to be going. And eventually, of course, it will pay off for Canadian private sector even more so. But it's a long process. It's not easy to get here.
Okay. Thank you, Chris. Hi, Chris. I'm Rob from Toronto. You've been doing a great job of connecting with a lot of people worldwide through social media and other means like this event today. What's the number one message that you really want people to take away from your mission in space?
You know, people always ask, what's it like in space? What's your favorite thing? The favorite thing is looking out the window. And that's not just because it's pretty. It's because it's fundamental to your soul to see the world this way, to be able to just, you know, when I was waiting for this to start, you can't help but go to the window and look and think about where we are. And my fundamental goal is to get people as best as I can to be able to see the world that way, to see it as one small place, one bubble of air that keeps us all alive, that we're responsible for, and just how close we are to each other. And it's a perspective that is healthy for us as a species, and it's one that we are very privileged to see, and I'm doing my very best to let everybody see that as clearly as I can.
You're doing a great job of it. Thank you.
Hey, Chris. It's Katrina from the Royal Astronomical Society of Canada. We all say hi. Astro-YYZ here. Anyway, as an amateur astronomer, I'm interested in knowing what astronomical objects can be seen from the ISS, given you have so many lights around you, lights and machines, and is there anywhere dark you can go on station where you can look out and really get dark adapted and see what's out there?
Yeah, sort of like a little kid leaving home. Most of our glances are back towards Mother Earth, but we do have windows that face the rest of the universe. And I spent some time looking at some actually yesterday, looking at one yesterday, and remarking on actually just your question that the sky is almost white with the light of the universe, with the uncountable number of stars. But it has a lot of variation to it, even just with the naked eye, when we're in the shade of the Earth, so we can really see it. You can see the whole dark sections where there's dark matter or dust or whatever it is that's between us and the rest of the universe. You can see the gradations of it, like looking into the deepest ocean, and you can see very bright spots. You can't see the constellations because the sky is just so alive with stars. It turns everyone into an amateur astronomer to be able to see the sky this way. I hope you get a chance someday to come up and just let it fill your head through your eyeballs. It's a wonderful sight.
Me too. Thank you. Hi, Chris. My name is Jennifer Nichols. I'm an elementary school teacher. And the question I have for you today is, being in a position that so much attention is focused on you and what you have achieved on your career so far, what message you would like to give to the people down here or the students down here that can maybe see their dreams but don't have the self-confidence to follow them?
You know, I read somewhere once an interview with Sir Paul McCartney of the Beatles, and he said that he feels insecure sometimes. He feels a lack of confidence sometimes. And he said to himself, gosh, if I feel that way, everybody must feel that way. And I really took something away from that. I thought, if one of the Beatles occasionally doesn't feel confident, doesn't have self-confidence, then that's universal. Everybody feels that way. And it's really only with each individual step of accomplishment that you start to build a sense of confidence in your own abilities. When I decided to be an astronaut, I had virtually no skills. I was 9 years old. But I thought, hey, I'm only nine. I'm not supposed to have very many skills yet, but I'm going to start working on it. I want to someday live on a space station. I want to command a spaceship. What do I do? How do I get there? And so I just every day started thinking about, well, how do I get there? What do I have to do? Well, I need to do well in middle school. I need to do well in high school. I need to understand what's going on. I need to learn to scuba dive. I need to not let my body get fat. I need to decide what I'm going to watch and read and just start turning myself into who I want to be. And with each one of those steps, learning to fly through the air cadets, each one of those little levels of accomplishment, I used to race downhill on various teams. With every small success comes a little bit of self-confidence in the things that you can accomplish, so that then when you're faced with a problem that's new to you, you can look at it and go, gosh, I don't know how to do that, but I'm pretty sure I'm going to be able to figure it out. And I treat everything the same way, whether it's learning to operate a camera like this one, which I'm not really all that good at, but I've learned well enough to be able to take some very good-looking pictures of the world, or to fly a spaceship, or to, tomorrow I'm recording a song playing a song with Ed Robertson and the Bare Naked Ladies. That's a pretty daunting thing, and those guys scare anybody. But you practice, and you learn, and you prepare, and you think about it, and you visualize. And it's amazing if you just take one little step of self-improvement at a time, where it can lead you and how much confidence it can give you.
Thank you. Hi, Chris. My name is Laura Austin from Sarnia, Ontario. And I was wondering if fractures or wounds heal faster in zero gravity.
Boy, I hope we never find out. We're living up here is quite different. It's a very sterile environment. I read somewhere that you're never more on the surface of the earth, you're never more than 10 feet away from a spider. Just if you count the number of spiders around. But I think on space station, I think the nearest spider is 400 kilometers away. We have lived in a very sterile environment up here. And for whatever reason, it changes our body's physiology, not just bone density and muscle strength, but also our immune system. Our immune system tends to depress a little, and we don't load our bones up as heavily because, as you can see, everything just floats. I don't even have to hold my head up. My head is floating on top of my neck. So we haven't broken a major bone up here, but my guess is they would heal more slowly just because they're not subject to all of the regular stressors that help our bodies be tough and strong and that we've evolved to over the last, however many million years. This is almost like trying to recover from something while you're floating in gelatin or maybe on a waterbed. And even though some things may look like they're happening quicker, whether they'll get that toughness and that tenacity and that interwoven strength that we need in order to stay healthy on Earth, I'm not sure. But we work really hard not to have any major wounds or to break our bones. I don't want to up here.
Thank you.
Okay, Chris, that's going to be our last question. I think your break is over. It's time for you to get back to work. I know you got a lot to do today. One big thank you to you from all of us here. We really appreciate it. And really, we only have one other word to describe what you're doing, and that's amazing. All the best to you. We'll talk to you again.
Hey, thanks, Jeremy. Let me just jump in before people applaud here. Let me just say that I'm sorry I didn't get to all the questions if there were more, but Jeremy is one of our crew support astronauts. I've known Jeremy, gosh, for over a decade. He's immensely capable and qualified, and I'm sure he'll be able to answer your questions. And thank you very much, Jeremy, for coming all the way up to host today and for taking care of the visitors to the space agency. It's an amazing place, the Canadian Space Agency. It makes this possible. And so we take a lot of pride in it, and have a good look around today, everybody. Thanks a lot, Jeremy. Hi to everybody at the Space Agency, and I need to get back to work. Bye-bye.
Station, this is Houston ACR. Thank you. That concludes the event.
Thank you, William Shatner and Twitter followers at the Canadian Space Agency. Station, we're now resuming operational audio communications.